Okay, the Gemara here begins on the top of Ted Zayin Amud Aleph. Taima Diga Edim. The reason in the Mishnah that we believe the woman is because there are Edim supporting her position, which is the Mishnah says, "Im Yesh Edim Shiatzat Behinuma Rosha Parua Ktubata Matayim." Because the Edim lend support to her position that she has a Ktubat Bitula, therefore we believe her. Ha Leka Edim. Had there not been Edim over here, we would have inferred that Baal Meheman, that the Baal is believed in this case. Leimat nan stama, delo k'Rabban Gamliel. Let us suggest, therefore, that this Mishnah is a stam Mishnah against the position of Rabban Gamliel, who we saw throughout the first parak. Because, in the first parak, Rabban Gamliel says, Hamar ihi mehemna. In all the cases of the Mishnayot in the first parak, the woman is given an extra status of believability. And if that is the case, why not over here? Does she not also have that status of believability? Must be that this Mishnah goes against that position of Rabban Gamliel. The Gemara says, Afilu Teima Rabban Gamliel. We can even have this Mishnah fit into the position of Rabban Gamliel, because there's a difference between this Mishnah and the Mishnayot in the previous parak. Adkan lo kamai Rabban Gamliel hatam. In the first parak, the reason Rabban Gamliel says that the woman is believed in all those cases is Ela Bibori Vishema. Because in each of those instances, she came with a definitive claim. Vishema and the other party, the husband in that case, had a claim of maybe or a suggestion. He did not have a definitive claim. And therefore, her bari, her definitive claim, trumped. Avahokha, in this case, bibari ubari. In this case, both parties have a definitive claim. She claims she was a bitula, and her ktubah was 200. He claims that she was a bi'ula, and her ktubah was 100. And they can both make definitive claims about this, so it's a bari ve'bari, and therefore lo amar. In that instance, Rabban Gamliel would agree that the woman doesn't have an extra level or status of believability over the husband, because here we're in an even playing field versus what we saw in the previous parak. Now, there is a question that's raised by many of the Rishonim over here as to what the status of this argument is. The woman here is making a claim of 200 zuz, the ktubah of a bitula. On the other hand, the husband is denying her that and saying that she only is entitled to a ktubat bi'ula of 100 zuz. That is what otherwise is known in the parlance of the Gemara as a moda b'miktzat. When a person is a moda b'miktzat, mina Torah, that individual has to take a shvuah. Over here, we don't see the Gemara talking about the need or the necessity for the husband to take a shvuah. So the Rishonim ask, why is this not classified as a moda b'miktzat? So different Rishonim take different approaches. Some suggest, and this is the Derech of the Yushami as well in this sugya, that there is no moda b'miktzat here, because as far as the 100 zuz are concerned, being the one that is entitled to a bi'ula, there is no argument about. That is something that the husband concedes, and that is something that gets or goes to every woman out there. So their only argument really is on the second 100 zuz, on the second maneh, and therefore this is not a case of moda b'miktzat, but rather an argument over 100 maneh, and therefore it's really a case of kofer bakol. The others, like the Rosh, that suggests over here, the reason that the husband doesn't take a shvuat moda b'miktzat is because the ktubah has a lien on the husband's property, and therefore it's the equivalent of what we call shibud karkaot, and we don't take a shvuah on shibud karkaot. We'll see that in the Gemarot later on. That is one of the exemptions with regards to shvuah, is something that is connected to shibud karkaot. And therefore over here, even though there might be moda b'miktzat according to the Rosh, there would not be a necessity for a shvuah. On the other hand, the Rambam believes that in Hokanami, that the Baal here has to take a shvuah midoraita, because this is a case of moda b'miktzat. And therefore, even though it's not mentioned in the Gemara, the Baal in this instance would have to take a shvuat moda b'miktzat. Now the Gemara says, Udika arila, maika arila. The questioner in this case, what was he thinking? When he challenged Rabban Gamliel from this Mishnah and said this Mishnah or Stam Mishnah seems to go against the position of Rabban Gamliel, it's so obvious what the answer was, that this case is a case of Bari Bibari, and the cases in the previous parak of Bari Vishema. So what was he thinking when he raised the question? Ha Bibari Barihu. It's very clear that our Mishnah is a case of Bari Ubari, and therefore the outcome or the decisive factors will be different than what we saw in the first parak. So Gemara says, "Kaven derov nashim bitulot nisot." Since majority of women who get married are bitulot, ki bari v'shema domi. He was suggesting that maybe our Mishnah is the equivalent of a bari and shema, meaning that her bari becomes, in a sense, a super bari, because she has a chazakah, or a robe, that really stands on her side, which is that robe nashim bitulot nisaot. So what we are doing is saying that the claims, even though they're both bari, on a relative basis, her claim has more strength on a definitive basis than his claim, and therefore our Mishnah looks similar to a bari and shema case. And that's why the questioner compared this Mishnah to the Mishnayot in the previous parak, even though on the surface it looks like they are talking about a different situation or a different case. Gemara says, V'hachanami b'stavro. This understanding of the Mishnah makes a lot of sense. Midiktani, because in the Sefer of the Mishnah it says, Umode Rabbi Yeshua, that Rabbi Yeshua agrees or admits in this case that the halacha should be such. If you say that the reisha of the Mishnah is really addressing Rabbi Gamliel's position, and Rabbi Gamliel is basically acquiescing that over here the woman is not ne'menet, as opposed to a shita in the previous parak, so then it would make sense that the latter half of the Mishnah has Rabbi Yoshua modeh. Eliyamart, lo ayri Rabbi Gamliel b'modeh. But if you say that Rabbi Gamliel is not admitting in the first half of the Mishnah that he does not have the same opinion as the previous parak, then Rabbi Yeshua the man modeh. Then who is Rabbi Yeshua addressing over here? Now, the way to read this Gemara, Rashi reads it very simply, and he says that if you talk about the ratio of this Mishnah, talking about a hoda'ah, that he, Rabbi Gamliel, is molded to Rabbi Yeshua, that in this case, that their din is different than in the previous parak, where it was Bari Vishema, I said that the woman is believed. But in this case, I admit that you are correct, that we will not say the woman is automatically believed, because this is more like a Bari Ubari case. Then the latter half of the Mishnah is reversed, where Rabbi Yeshua comes back and he agrees to Rabbi Gamliel's position and says, even though in the past I believed that the woman was not believed or the claimant was not believed, over here in the latter half of the Mishnah, I say that the person is believed, even though that isn't my opinion everywhere else. And therefore there is a parallel, in a sense, of Rabbi Gamliel agreeing to Rabbi Yeshua, and then Rabbi Yeshua in the latter half agreeing to Rabbi Gamliel. Now, Tosfot already raises the issue with Rashi's explanation of the Gemara. He says, "Bekasha the perush show ki chilo ayri nami gamel b'modeh atushaper mode Rabbi Yeshua." Even without the admission of Rabbi Gamliel in the first half of the Mishnah, it would be easy to say mode Rabbi Yeshua in the latter half of the Mishnah. There's no reason why Rabbi Gamliel has to agree to Rabbi Yeshua in the first half in order for Rabbi Yeshua to agree to Rabbi Gamliel in the latter half of the Mishnah. So Tosfot comes up with an answer that quasi supports this position of Rashi and says, "Eishle Hashem, the Vaday ki Ari Rabbi Gamliel modeh shariach lemitnei shapir modeh Rabbi Yeshua afagav d'lavi minyan echad." Even though our Mishnah really changes topics from the first half to the second half, then it wouldn't be relevant to say modeh Rabbi Yeshua in the second half when it's a totally different situation or circumstance, unless the first half of the Mishnah was also dealing with a similar modeh Rabbi Gamliel to Rabbi Yeshua. But had the first half of the Mishnah not been Rabbi Gamliel admitting to Rabbi Yeshua, then to have the latter half of the Mishnah saying Rabbi Yeshua is admitting to Rabbi Gamliel, even though the topic has changed, would have been incorrect or would not have sat well in the Mishnah. So that's how Tosafot tries to explain Rashi's explanation of the Mishnah. On the other hand, V'niru l'ri, the Ri gives another interpretation, Hachi perusho, Hachi nami mistavre de gabori u'shem adomi. That the Hachi nami mistavre is not going on the modeh, but on the bari v'shema aspect of it. And he says that if you see or view the first half of the Mishnah as being a bari and shema, and yet Rabbi Gamliel agrees in that case that the halacha is similar to Rabbi Yeshua's position, that the woman is not believed in that case, then we can understand the modeh of Rabbi Yeshua in the later half of the Mishnah. And Tosafot says, because we would have had a havamina that Rabbi Yeshua's position is premised on Bari Veshema on the latter half of the Mishnah, not on Migo. And in the end, when we have the mode of Rabbi Gamliel in the first half saying it's a Bari Veshema, then Rabbi Yeshua in the latter half is really saying that the believability here comes from a Migo. The difference being whether it's a admission that Rabbi Yeshua believes that it is a Bari, and whether Rabbi Yeshua believes that the reason the difference between whether we believe Rabbi Shua thinks that it's Bari B'Shema, and that's why he thinks the individuals believed in the latter half first of its amigo, has to do with Machloket Rashi and Tosafot and the Mishnah, as to whether if there's a claimant here against the other party, do we believe them? So if you think that it's because of Bari B'Shema, when you have a claimant on the other side making a Bari claim, then Rabbi Shua would not agree to this position. On the other hand, if you think that the believability here of the individual who says that it is your father's, but I bought it from your father, that would be even in the face of the possibility that the person's making a claim, and therefore he's believed because of amigo. And therefore, Tosafot says that's what's meant over here, that Hakinam and Mistavra, that the Mishnah is really a case of Bari V'Shema, and even so, Rabban Gamliel agrees. And therefore, in the latter half, when it says Modi Rabbi Shua, it's not because it's a Bari V'Shema that he agrees, but rather because it's a Migo that he agrees. So now the Gemara continues and says, wait a minute, is it really true that Rabbi Yeshua would have to be addressing the Modev Rabban Gamliel in the ratio of the Mishnah? Misbarat Rabbi Yeshua Hai Pirkin Koi. Who says that Rabbi Yeshua, when we say Modi Rabbi Shua, is referencing the Mishnah at hand here? Maybe Amigo Koi. He's going back on the Migo Vapirkin Kama Koi. And he's going back to the first parak, meaning that Modi Rabbi Yeshua is not a reference to the Mishnah at hand, but rather a reference back to the Mishnayot in the first parak. And over here, Modi Rabbi Yeshua is vis-a-vis his opinion in the first parak. Mar says, ahai. On which Mishnah in the first parak are we addressing that? It says here, Modi Rabbi Yeshua. Iveima. Now the Gemara is going to go through the Mishnayot in reverse order, because obviously the latter Mishnah in the first parak would be more likely to be the reference point for Modi Rabbi Yeshua. Haitami uberet vamrula mativu tivo shel uber zeh. She was found to be pregnant, and they asked her, what is the status, or where did this child come from? Mish ploni v'koenu. She says, from so-and-so, and he is a kohen. Rabbi Gamliel v'Rabbi Eliezer omer ne'emenet. She is believed. Rabbi Yeshua omer, lo mipi anu chaim. We do not go by the word of her mouth. Hata my migo iko. Over there, what migo is there? Har krisa ben shina. She really doesn't have an alternative claim over there, because she has a baby. And a baby, there's no bigger edut that she had bia in that case. And therefore, she can't deny the fact that she had bia. The only question is, the bia that she had, what type of bia was it? So there's really no migo, there's no better claim that she can make over there. Elaha, must be on the Mishnah prior to that. Ra'ua midaberet imechad. They saw her speaking, quote-unquote, to another individual. Ramula mativo shel ish ze. What is the status of this individual? And she answers, Ishploni v'koenu, so-and-so, and he is a kohen. Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Lez Omer, ne'emenet. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, lo mipia anu chayin. Rabbi Yeshua says, we don't go by the word of her mouth. Hata my migo iga. What migo is there in that Mishnah? Hanicha l'ziri. If we explain that Mishnah according to Ziri, damai amar my midaberet, who explained the word midaberet as a euphemism for nistara, that she was secluded with this individual, that there was yichud, migo di bai amra lo nivalti. Because she has the possibility of claiming that she never had bia, bigamra nivalti, but she says that did have bia, but I had bia with this kasher, then mehemna, she's believed, there is a bigo. Elder Ravasi, damar my midaberet, according to Ravasi, who says the definition of midaberet over there is a euphemism for nivelet, that she had bia, my migo iga. Over there's no longer a migo, because we know she had bia. We have a dot that she had bia, and therefore she has no alternative claim. Once we know she had bia, the only question is who she had bia with him. Who she had bia with. Elaha must be on the Mishnah even before that, which is he omeret mukat eitzani. She claims that she lost her betulim from some natural occurrence. V'omer lo kela drusat ishat. But he claims no, the reason that she doesn't have betulim is because she had bia with another individual. Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Lezer omrim ne'menet. She is believed. Rabbi Yeshua omer lo mipia anu chaim. Again, we do not rely on her word, we do not live by her word. Hata my migo iko. Over there, what's the migo? What's the alternative claim over there? Everybody here agrees that she does not have bitulim. She agrees and he agrees. Just a question of how she doesn't have bitulim. Bishma le Rabbi Elazar damar bimanev lo klum. According to Rabbi Elazar, who says that the machloket here is whether she will collect 100 zuz or nothing. Migo di bay amra mukat eitzani tachteha, tachtecha. Because she could claim that I was a mukat eitz after I had married you already, v'itla mataim, and then she would have collected 200 zuz, because that means at the time of Erusin, she was a bitula. If that's the case, when she became a mukat eitz under him, it's nistachfa sadehu. It's as if his bad mazel caused the problem. and she's entitled to Matayim Zuz. Since she does not make that claim, Vika Amra Mikara, and she agrees or admits that this happened prior to the Erusim, the late La Elamane, and therefore she hurts her claim. She's not giving the best claim she could give. And if she had wanted to lie, she would have had a better lie to keep 200 zuz. And instead, she agrees that she's only entitled to 100 zuz. Mehemna, that is a migo that she would believe by. El Rabbi Yochanan, according to Rabbi Yochanan, where we saw before in the previous paragraph in that Mishnah, Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar argue about what the Mishnah says are the two sides over there. Damar b'matayim u'maneh, that the argument there is whether she collects 200 zuz or 100 zuz. My migo ika. Over there, she has no better claim. The claim that she's making here about Mukat H entitles her, Mukat H entitles her to 200 zuz. Well, that 200 zuz is what she'll get if she made even a better claim. There's no better claim that she can get because 200 zuz is the maximum she could get. And therefore, my amigo Iko, over there there's no amigo according to Rabbi Yochanan because she has no better claim. Elaha must be on the Mishnah even before that. I know it, and said to Isha v'lo matzala bitulim, he married a woman and finds her not to be a bitula. He omered, she makes the claim, Mishir Astani Nenasti, that after the Erusin, I was raped, and therefore it's his bad mazel that caused this problem. But he claims, no, that it happened prior to the Erusin, and therefore she really was a bi'ula when I married her. Say that she is believed. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, lo mipi anu chayim. But on the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua says, we don't go by the word of her mouth. Demigo. Because over there, there is a migo. Di by amra, mukateitz ani tachtecha. Because she could have made a claim over there that she's a mukateitz, that she lost it by natural means, and it happened after the Erusin. Loka pasla nafsham yikuna. And in that case, she would then not be asura to marry a kohen afterwards. Bi kamra. And despite the fact that she had that claim that would keep her as a ksheira de kuna, and instead, she makes the claim, Bekamar Nenasti, which, again, in terms of the monies of the Ketubah, doesn't change anything, but it does change her status vis-a-vis the Kohanim, the Kapasla Nafsham Ikuna. From here to forward, she would not be able to marry a Kohen. She would no longer be Kshira the Kuna. Shemhochi Kamar Rabbi Gamliel de Mehemno. That's why Rabbi Gamliel says she is believed, because there's a Migo over there. Bekamar Rabbi Yeshua the Rabbi Gamliel. And Rabbi Yeshua responds to Rabbi Gamliel and says, Bahai Migo de Hocha, Modina de Hocha. And the Migo over here, I agree with you. Versus the Migo in the previous parak where I disagreed and said she is not believed. In this case of our Mishnah by the Sadeh, I say that there is a Migo that is believed. So, Baha'i, Baha'u Migo Duhaton Peligno Ilavech. But over there, Baha'i Migo Duhachom Adinalach. In the Migo over here, I do agree with you. Baha'u Migo Duhaton, but the Migo in that previous parak, Peligno Ilavech. I argue or disagree with your position over there. So, obvious question now is, Michtei, Hi Migo. The high Migo. They're both a Migo. Why should Rabbi Yeshua believe one Migo over another Migo? So that's what the Gemara says here. Michtei high Migo, high Migo. Maishna high Migo, me high Migo. What's the difference between them? Hacha ein shor shachut lefanecha. Hata marei shor shachut lefanecha. Says because there's a difference in the status of the cases. In the case over here, there is no shechted shor in front of us. Whereas over there, there is a shechted shor in front of us. So as Rashi explains over here, Gabe ein shor shechut lefanecha, shalei lev laba alav litvoa. Over here, there's no reason or evidence that would make the person come to court and say, that was my father's field. The only reason that we're in court, or the only reason we're discussing this is because the defendant is saying that it was his father's field. I mean, he's the only one who admitted to this. There's no reason or nothing that would have triggered or caused the party to come to court and make a claim, except for the fact of the omission of the defendant. So therefore, there's no shechted shor in front of us. There's nothing of evidence in front of us that would force us to come to court and make a claim. On the other hand, in the Mishnah, in the first parak, there is a shor shechut lefanecha because this individual found this woman not to be a betula. So the fact that he found her not to be a betula, she's got already now answer for that. The reason we're in court is not because she told us what happened. We're in court now because the husband thinks there's something wrong and he found something wrong. So since there's already something in front of us, then it weakens her migo over there because the reason that she has to answer or come up with an answer is because someone's making a claim against her and that claim didn't come from her. It didn't come from her admission that we have the claim over here. And therefore, even though she has a good answer to the reason that it happened, but the fact that she didn't volunteer the information, or she was coached or told how to answer the question. That's why she's answering in such a manner. It's not just coming voluntarily from her. That's the way Rashi explains the Hare Shor Shachut Lefanecha. Now this really relies on Rashi's explanation of the Mishnah, whereby Rashi says the reason that Rabbi Yeshua agrees in the case of the Mishnah is because in the case of the field in the Mishnah, the claimant is not coming and making a claim. This is all being volunteered by the defendant in that case. But had the other party showed up in court and said, that was my father's field, according to Rashi, that would fall apart, and the defendant would no longer have the Pesha Asu or Pesha Hitir. On the other hand, according to Tosafot and many of the other Rishonim, that even in the face of a claim by the party that says that's my father's field, the defendant would still be believed unless Edim come and deny him that right, then Rashi's explanation here of the difference between this Mishnah and the previous Mishnah doesn't make any sense. And therefore, Tosafot offers up an alternative shot, which is that both cases there's a claimant. But rather the explanation over here is she doesn't have betulim. She has no possibility of saying that she's a betula at this point. Just like by a shore that is shechted, you can't say it's alive. So to this woman who is coming before us can't claim that she is a betula. Whereas in this case, the individual can make the claim that it was never your father's property. And he can make the greatest claim, which is, whatever you're saying is not true, because your father never owned this property whatsoever. In the case in the previous parak, the woman cannot say, I was a bitula, none of this is true, because you can't say that a shor shachut is alive. Just like she can't say a bitula is a bitula. She's clearly a bitula, and now she has to give explanation for it, and that's why that diminishes her migo over there. And the expression is just saying that this woman has less maneuverability on her side. There's already some questions raised about her because of the fact that we found her to be a bi'ula. And therefore, her nemanut is somewhat compromised by that situation. And that's the way Tosafot explains it, because he disagrees fundamentally with Rashi about this idea that if the claimant shows up, then the defendant wouldn't be believed. Because according to Tosafot, as we spoke out yesterday, he believes that in the Mishnah, even if the claimant came and said that it was my father's property, the defendant would still be believed with the claim that, yes, it was your father's property, but I purchased it from him. So now the Gemara goes back and asks the question and says, V'kevin derob nashim bitulot nis'ot, since the majority of women are bitulot when they get married, kilo ato edim mayhavi. When there are no edim over here, what is the din? Meaning that if you over here don't have edim, we said that the husband is believed. Why don't we say the woman is believed? Because she has this robe that now supports her. Now, Tosafot asks the question and says there is a machloket about robe when it comes to money. And that is a machloket Rav and Shmuel and the Gemara and Baba Kama and other places, where Rav says, holchim achar rov by mamon. And Shmuel says, ein holchim achar rov by mamon. Rav says, we do follow majority when it comes to monetary matters. Shmuel says, we do not follow the majority when it comes to monetary matters. And therefore, Tosafot says that this question in the Gemara is only according to Rav Shita, who says we follow the rov by mamon. And the Gemara wants to know now, if we have a rov over here, based on what we said earlier in the Gemara, that rov, nashim bitulot nisot, then that rov should favor the woman's explanation over here, and we should give her a ketubat matayim. You can see over here on the side that there is a Tosafot Yishanim that also deals with this question, but answers differently. It says this question could even be according to Shmuel. And that is because over here, the woman has an additional factor, which is what's called cheskat aguf. We saw that earlier in the first parak, that her chazaka is that she is a bitula. So you have the chazaka that she is a bitula, the rove that the majority of women getting married are bitulot. So between the two of those, this is actually a stronger rove than a normal rove. It's like a super rove. And because of that, even Shmuel would agree over here that holchim achar rove b'mamon. And therefore, the question is equally relevant for Shmuel as it is for Rav. So the question of the Gemara is simply, if we have a rove over here, why do we need a dim? So Amaravina Mishum Dika Lameimar Rov Nashim Bitulot Nisot Umiot Almanot. So because if we look at this picture here, majority of women who get married are bitulot. There's a minority of women getting married who are almanot. B'chol Haniseit Bitula Yesh Lakol. On the other side of this, we have any woman that got married as a bitula is a public affair and is something that is well known to the public. B'zu Ol Vein Lakol. But here, since we don't have this public rumor or well-known circumstance that she was married as a Betula, Itra La Ruba, that now detracts or ruins the robe over here. So basically, what the Gemara says is that there's an offsetting factor over here, a mitigating factor to the robe over here. Yes, we have a robe. Majority of women who get married are Betulot. But on the other hand, there's also a factor, which is that majority of women who are Betulot that get married is a public issue and it's well known to the public. The fact that nobody is coming by here and telling us this information means that maybe it did not happen. So therefore, that ruins the robe for her because she doesn't have all the trappings of what should be associated with that robe. The robe of women get married are Betulot. In addition to that, then the public knowledge should have been an outcome of that. The lack of that public knowledge now makes us question whether the robe really applies to this woman. Mara says, "E kol nash kol anisot bitula yesh lakol ki adudim mayhavi." If you are right about this, that the principle here is that any woman who gets married, it's a public affair and it's widely known. Then when adim show up and testify to her behalf, what does that do for you? Hanach sade shakrininu. These adim are lying. Because, now this is a very difficult statement, because anywhere else in the Torah we would believe two Edim. Why all of a sudden do we not believe the two Edim? We're looking for public knowledge, and all of a sudden two Edim show up. So why shouldn't we believe them? Maybe they are the public knowledge. So we shouldn't even have different ways of framing this, but basically saying that either the statement that this is a public affair when a Betulah gets married is such a strong chazakah, then when the Edim come to testify against it, it's almost as if there are Edim on the other side because the Chazakah is so strong that we believe it would have been a public issue. Or, if it was that these Edim knew about the information, then the information should have been public because the whole idea of this becoming public is that these Edim know about it and other people would have known about it because of the publicity of such a matter. And they actually would have been in the cause of that publicity. The fact there is no publicity, even though they have this information, makes us question whether these Edim are really telling the truth over here. El Amar Avina, we have to reword this at this way, which is Rov Hanis Eit Bitula Yesh La Kol. Majority of women who get married as a Bitula have a kol. Bisu Ho Vein La Kol Itla Ra Ruba. So over here, we're not saying that definitively, that any woman who gets married as a Bitula, it is a public issue. Again, we're saying there that it's a Rov. So over here, we have a rove of women that get married are Betulot. On the other side of that, we say the majority of women who are Betulot, when they get married, that becomes a public issue. So now, in the case where we just have those two pieces of information, that takes down the original rove. You have a majority of women are Betulot, a miut, a minority that are Almanot. Then we have a majority of women who get married as Betulot, that is a well-known issue. And on the hand of that, we have a miut that are not known. So now all of a sudden you have these mitigating factors against each other. And as Tosafot points out, that it's not so strong, this idea or this robe, that the robe of Bitulot or public issue is not as strong as the robe of women that are getting married are Bitulot. And therefore the robe of marrying getting Bitulot still carries weight over here, or still has more weight than the other side. Not enough to offset that mitigating factor, but together with a deem or other points of evidence, that would be strong enough to overcome the problem. And that's what the answer of the Gemara is in the end, that nothing here is definitive on either side. And therefore, with the bolstering of evidence, either by Edim or other factors that Tosafot discusses over here, we would give precedence to the rove that the majority of women who get married are Bitulot. Right now, the Gemara says, "Im yesh edim she'etzdab hinuma. Belechush, let us worry about the fact that Dilma mafke edim b'hai bedina." She's going to show up in this Beit Din with a Din that she went out with a Hinuma or whatever trappings of a Bitula, the Gavio. And then she will collect based on that her Ketubah of 200 Zuz. V'hadar mafka la Ketubah b'hai Beit Din. Then she'll go to another Beit Din and pull out her Ketubah, the Gavio ba. And then she will collect based on that. If we're allowing her to collect simply by the testimony of a Din over here, it's very possible that she has the Ketubah in her back pocket. She's not showing it to us now. She's using the Edim, but then she'll show up in another Beit Din and make a second claim against the husband with her Ketubah. So then, how do we solve for that problem? So Amar Rabbi Abahu, Zoto Merit, Kotvim Shover, that from here you can conclude that you have to write a receipt, meaning that the woman has to write a receipt to the husband saying that it was paid. Rapapa Amar, B'makom Shein Kotvim, Ketubah Askinan, This is a location in which they do not write ktubot. Since they do not write ktubot, there's no possibility she pull out the ktubah in another location. Now, the truth is that she could show up in another location and pull out edim again. And as Tosva points out over here, he would need a receipt in either case. Whether she has the ktubah in hand, or whether she came with edei hinuma, he needs a shover to prove against these edei hinuma showing up again in another beit din. So what Tosafot says in the end is that there are different levels of ease by which she can collect. To bring edei hinuma to the beit din is not a simple matter. She did it once, the likelihood that she'd be able to pull it off again would be low, and therefore giving a shover and the necessity for a shover there would be very low. On the other hand, if she's still holding the document of the ktubah in her hand, then the necessity for a shover would be very high, because then with ease she could take out the document and go to a beit din and claim it. So therefore you would need a shover. Now the machloket here between Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Papa is a broader machloket about the necessity for giving receipts, because the giving of a receipt puts an obligation on the party or the paying party now to guard the receipt in order to make sure that he doesn't get claimed that against. So generally the Gemara has this argument with regards to amal ven aloveh, a lender, a creditor, and a debtor. When the creditor comes to collect from the debtor says, I want a receipt, or I want the shtar back. The creditor says, I don't have the shtar, I can't give it back to you. So then we force the creditor to give a shover. Over there, the argument is whether the creditor has a right to make a claim. Do we obligate the loveh to hold on to the receipt now forever because the creditor claimed the shtar is lost, and then maybe you pull it out later, so he has to now guard this receipt? Or do we say the fact that the creditor can't bring the shtar here, he won't get his money. That's his loss. He didn't bring this shtar here. That's too risky for the debtor, and we don't ask him to hold on to a shover. So it's clear that Rabbi Avo says that we do write a shover. From here, we could prove that the fact that we do write receipts, and we do put that obligation on the other party. The reason given by the Loven, the Malveh, is that the Pasuk in Mishle says that the Loveh is Eved L'Ish Malveh. That the Loveh, in the end, the debtor, is basically in servitude to the creditor. And therefore, all the obligations are going to fall on the debtor. So in this case, we say, yes, debtor, you're going to have to hold on to this receipt because you've got to do whatever is necessary to take care of this creditor. And therefore, you'll pay him and you'll hold on to the receipt. Now, obviously, that has broader implication, meaning that Tosafot says this as well, that it's not only by loveh and malveh, but it's even by any relationship in which there is a creditor and a debtor in this case. So the person who's going to have to hold over the shover in this case will be the Baal, and we're going to obligate him to do this. On the other hand, Rapapa says, we're not going to. We don't want to prove anything here about shover, because maybe we wouldn't obligate the individual to hold on to the shover. It's too big an obligation to ask the husband to do this. But rather, the case is being made a case where they don't write a ketubah. So there's no risk of her showing up with a ketubah in another location, and that's why there's no need for a shover over here. But that's why she can only make the claim once. And again, based on Tosafot, it would be harder for her to come back again with a day hinuma to try to make a claim, and therefore even if she gives a shover, he won't have to be as careful about it because the likelihood of being claimed against him again is very low. Some say that this machloket Rabbi Bo and Rabbi Papa is actually on this braita, which is ibda ktubata, she lost her ktuba. Hitmina ktubata, she says, I hid my ktuba and I can't find it. Nisrifa ktubata, or she claims that her ktuba was burnt up. Rakdu lefaneha, if they danced before her, sachaku lefaneha, or they did all sorts of comic relief in front of her. Heviru lefanekos shel bisora. They passed in front of her a cup of good news. We'll see later on in the Gemara what that means. Omapas shel bitulim, or the sheet of the bitulim. Im yesh la edim bechad mikol elu. If she can bring edim that testify that any one of these items happened in front of her at her wedding, tubata matayim. Because then for sure, she was a bitula. These are only activities that people engage in front of a bitula. So if she has evidence of the fact that any of these happened, then she certainly was a bitula when she got married. Mar says, the same question we had on our Mishnah on this braita, maybe she'll bring out the edim that this happened in this beit din and collect, and then she'll pull out her ktuba in the other beit din and collect again. You see from this that we write a receipt, and then the Baal will keep the receipt, and that's what we'll protect him against such a thing happening. It's a case or a place where they don't write a ktuba. So Gemara asks right away, wait, Rapapa's answer is a little strange. Doesn't the Braita say, Vaha ibda ktuba taktani? So what does it mean that he doesn't have a ktuba? It's a place where they don't give ktubot. It says over here that she lost her ktuba. That means that she did have a ktuba. So Gemara says, the cut of law, iyo. that he did write it, even though the minhag ha-makom was that they didn't write tubot, he nevertheless gave her a written ktubah. So the Gemara says, sof sof mafkile v'gavyoba. So then in the end, she could pull that out and collect with it, even though this is a place that doesn't have the minhag to have a ktubah. The fact that he wrote it one for her, now makes it possible or plausible for her to pull it out, even though she's making a claim now that it was lost. The Gemara says, ma'ivda. So then what does it mean that it got lost? Ivda be'or. That means that it was lost in the fire. So according to Rav Papa's explanation, that it's a place where they didn't write a ktubah, but in the end they did write a ktubah, then there's a likelihood that she could pull it out. If that's the case, how can you claim over here that this is a protection against her pulling it out because it's a place that doesn't write a ktubah? She did write a ktubah. The Gemara says, no, ivda over here means literally lost forever, that she can't pull it out again because it was lost in the fire. Gemara says, ihachi hainu nisrifa. That's the same as the latter part of the braita that says it got burnt up. Ba'od. And then there's the middle case, hitmina, ma'igala meymar. The middle case where she clearly says that she hid it and it's lost now. That's not a case where it's gone legamre. Vitu, in addition to that, ivda lomali. What do you need the term ivda? Some people say that this question is seemingly redundant because it's the same question that we asked before, which is that if you claim that ivda is nisrafa, then why do you need Nisrafa in the Mishnah? And this is just the reverse of that question. So many left this out of the Girsa. On the other hand, Rashi does include it and keeps it in the Girsa. And it's a more general question, which is, if you think Ivda means destroyed in some way, not burnt, then don't use the word Avad. Avad means temporarily lost and it could be found. Ivda does not mean destroyed or gone forever. So some view the question in that manner. But whatever that the question may be, the problem in this Breita is that for Rapopo, the solution does not work. Just because it's a place where they didn't write a ketubah, that's not going to help here because he did write her a ketubah, and the ketubah could still be in existence. So how is this a protection in any way? Ella, you have to reread the bright or amend the bright to read this way, and that will then fit into Rav Papa's explanation, which is, kol ivda, anything that is lost, ki hit mina bifaneinu dami. Any claim that she makes that the ketubah was lost is the equivalent of her saying that I put it away, I stored it away, and I lost it. And therefore, she will not be believed. We will not pay her ketubah out, because in that case, she could pull the ketubah out and collect the second time. But we will give her ad damre edim nisrafak ketubata. Thus, she can bring evidence of the fact that the ketubah was destroyed, and therefore, we're not going to worry about her pulling the ketubah out a second time. Now, what's interesting over here, and Tosafot asked the question, in two forms. One is, if he wrote her a ketubah the first time, even in a place where there was no minhag to write the ketubah, who says when she lost it, he didn't replace it, and now she has a ketubah in hand, even though it was burnt? Or number two is, in a place where they do write a ketubah, why can't the answer of Rav Papa be the same over here, which is, until she has evidence of the fact that the ketubah was destroyed, then we will not allow her to collect here, because that's what Rav Papa's statement is. So if it was destroyed even in a place where they write the ketubah, maybe she should be able to collect. So Tosafot says there's actually a difference. That in a place where the minhag is to write a ketubah, when she loses her ketubah, the Baal will write her another ketubah, and we can assume that he wrote her another ketubah because it's asur to keep a woman without a ketubah. In a place where the minhag is not to write a ketubah, then if she loses the ketubah, the likelihood that the husband will write her a second ketubah against the minhag is very low. And therefore we don't have to be choshesh for it. And that's why Rav Papa says that the case here is a case of a place or location where they don't normally give a ketubah. He did give it this time, but if it got destroyed, we can assume there was no replacement made. That would not be true in a place where they normally wrote ketubot, that if it was lost or burnt, he would have replaced it, and we can assume that he did replace it, and therefore we have to worry about it showing up again. And that's why Rav Papa's answer to the braita is only in a case where a makom she'en kotvin la ketubah. Although the Rashba over here does say that Rav Papa over here switched his position, and he believes that this would be true even in a place where they write a ketubah, and Rav Papa actually changed his mind. The Gemara says, "Man d'matni lo braita koshkena mitnitan." The one who says that Rav Papa and Rabbi Abahu's argument is relevant by the braita certainly will say the same thing as an answer to the question vis-a-vis our Mishnah. "Man d'matni lo matnitan." The one who says that their machloket is relevant by our Mishnah, avala braita lo. Because they would not necessarily extrapolate that or give the same answer by the Braita, Kikushya, because of the difficulty of explaining Rav Papa's position in the Braita. And maybe even Rav Papa would agree in the Braita that you would have to say Kodvin Shover because of that difficulty, and therefore, Just because we say it on the Mishnah doesn't mean they would argue equally on the Braita, because it doesn't fit so well into the language of the Braita until we amended the Braita. Okay, now the Gemara continues, Yesh Edim, with the Hinuma, V'lechush Dilma Mafka Ede Hinuma by Beitin, V'gavyo. Why don't we worry about the fact that she'll bring Ede Hinuma here, and this Beitin and collect? V'adar Mafka Ede Hinuma Beitin Achrina, V'gavyo. And then she'll go to another Beitin and make the same claim again. Gemara says, V'makom Dula Efshar, in a place where there's no choice, Vade Kadvin and Shover, then we definitely write a receipt. Where there's no way to protect the husband except through a Shover, then we will write a Shover for him. And this goes back to what Tosafot said before, that in either instance, she's going to need a Shover, whether it's a case of Ede Hinuma, or whether there's a case of Ketubah, though the difference will be that if she has a Ketubah in her hand, it's much more dangerous because of the ease by which she could collect, and therefore the Shover is much more important. But Ede Hinuma, even though she could pull them out again, it's a much more difficult undertaking, and therefore, even though the Shover is difficult to keep or watch, nevertheless, he will be able to basically manage it because the likelihood of her pulling out Ede Hinuma again is very low. Hivir lefanah kos shel bisorah. My kos shel bisorah. What is this kos shel bisorah that we saw before in the bright that was an indication that this woman was a betula? Amar Rav Adarbava kos yain shel truma. They used to take out a cup of wine that was truma. Mavir and lefanah. And they used to pass it in front of her, or dance with it in front of her. Klomar. As if to say, ruya haitazu lechol bit truma. This woman is ra'ui to eat truma. And if she married a kohen, she is ru'uya to eat the truma because she's getting married as a bitula, and therefore she is ru'uya to marry a kohen as a bitula, and therefore she could have eaten truma. Wait a minute. Since when does a widow not eat truma? Even if a widow gets married to a kohen, that's a permissible marriage, and he can eat truma as well. Zo reshit ki truma reshit. This woman is her first. She is a bitula. Just like Truma is called Reshit. So just like Truma is called Reshit, this, for this woman, this is her first marriage and she is a Betula. It is a Mashal of parallel, which is that just like Truma is considered to be the first, this is the first for this woman. Tani Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda on the other hand says, this is what they did. Chavicha Yain Marvin Lefanah. They used to take a barrel of wine and pass it in front of her. Amar Rav Adarbava Betula Marvin Lefanah Stuma. If she's a Betula, they keep the barrel of wine covered, as if to say that she is sealed, she is a bitula. Bi'ula, on the other hand, if she's a bi'ula, marvin lefanah p'tucha. They used to pass or dance with a barrel of wine that was open in order to indicate that this woman is a bi'ula. Gemara says, am I? Why do it this way? Ne'aver kameh bitula, v'kameh bi'ula, lo ne'aver klal. Why don't we only do this siman by a bitula and do nothing by a bi'ula? And the absence of this siman wouldn't be indicative of the fact that she is a bi'ula. Why do we have to do an active siman in front of the bi'ula? Mar says, zimni de tafsa matayim. Sometimes she'll grab 200 zuz. V'amra ana bitula avai. And she says, I really was a bitula. V'hai delo avru kamai. So how come they didn't pass the barrel back and forth in front of me? It nu sehu ditnisu. Something went wrong. There was some issue at the wedding that didn't allow them to do this. They spilled the barrel. Rashi says they were drinking and they got shikur, that they already were drunk at that point in time, and therefore they didn't have the wherewithal in order to pass it back and forth. So the absence of the barrel, she says, is not evidence of the fact that I wasn't a betula. It happened because of whatever accident, they didn't pass it in front of me. On the other hand, when it comes to Ede Hinuma and items like that, they happen before or earlier on in the ceremony before they start to drink, and therefore there's no question about Inusa. If she doesn't have those simanim, then that is problematic, because those simanim are definitive in saying that she is a bitula. Over here, the solution to the problem is that we also do it in front of a bitula. So she can't claim that it wasn't done in front of her, because they do it in front of a bitula and a bitula. So just because there's an absence over here does not mean that she's right, because they would have done something in front of her, whether she was a bitula or a bitula. And therefore, the absence now means more than simply they had an accident and they couldn't do it. The absence doesn't prove automatically that she's a bitula. The absence could be that she is a bula or bitula because they do something in front of both parties now. And therefore, absence is not anymore a claim for her. And that's why we do something in front of the bitula and in front of the bitula. Okay, we're going to stop here on the bottom of Tet Zayin Amud Bet, 2 lines from the bottom.